Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, John Schwab here from Curtain Call, and welcome to episode 125 of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, the podcast that brings you backstage as close as you possibly can be, often while the shows are actually happening, to meet the people that make theater happen. And just a quick reminder, you can download and subscribe to the podcast from the Apple Podcast app or from iTunes. That way your feed will be automatically updated when we release an episode. But you can also listen to us on many other streaming services such as Stitcher and Google Play and the like. Please rate and review our podcast if you can, please, if you have a spare 30 seconds, really quick. It does help us reach more theater lovers out there around the globe. So I thank you in advance. And now for this week's podcast. I have had the privilege of knowing this week's guest for over a decade now, and I am so thrilled that she was able to come over to the studio and sit down to chat for a while. Screenwriter, playwright, Janet Jones has had an astonishing career. She's worked for just about every studio out there, and not just as a writer, but, I mean, that's just the beginning. She's written lyrics, poetry, worked as a tour guide for a major Hollywood studio, been a writer's assistant, script editor, and she's even making her own podcast. I mean, I can't really keep up with this lady. She is astonishingly busy. She always has a ton of projects on the go, and that's why it was so interesting to sit down and talk to her. She's a working writer, right? And you don't get to sit down and chat with many of those every day. At least I don't. So please sit back and listen to an extraordinary story of how somebody goes from Motown to the Tower of London in just one lifetime. Have a listen. Here we are.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I am sitting here with Janet Jones, who is quite a prolific writer. And full disclosure, we've known each other for quite some time.
We have.
And in a roundabout way, I mean, we were introduced. You needed help putting on a reading or something.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I think instantly we became friends. So, yeah. But it's been a while. I think it was back to, you know, people on the podcast heard me talk about being at the Old Vic, and it was back in my Old Vic days.
Yes, it was. Yeah, because we did something upstairs at the Vic that we did with the class.
Right.
I came and helped with that class.
That.
Talking about
kids. Is right. So
yes.
We talked about, gosh, that was back when, you know, producing days and film producing.
That's right.
Which is funny, like, just start on a complete tangent. Like, you know, I'm sitting here talking to an American who is we call multi-hyphenates these days.
Right.
Because,
right.
Like, I don't just act. I direct, I've produced, I've written, I've done whatever. Right. You don't just write as well. You've produced and you've...
Right.
But when you write across the board.
I do write across the board. You know, isn't that weird? Isn't
you're not just weird? You're not just a playwright or a screenwriter. You novels, everything, fiction. I mean, everything.
Poetry. And I've just come back to writing lyrics after bloody, 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 bloody years. when I started out at Motown as a songwriter apprentice.
Oh my gosh. All right.
No, see, okay. You didn't even know that, did you?
Interview. I had no idea. So let's take me back then. Was that how you started out, Janet? Is that what?
That was the first real writing gig I had, yeah. I was going to the Hollywood Songwriters Workshop. It was, I believe, Tuesday nights, right off of Hollywood Boulevard. I went for a couple of years. You know, there were summer breaks and winter breaks, and that was something you just did. And I don't even know that we paid. It was really like you went, and it was a group of songwriters. The guy who led the group was a real Joni Mitchell, Cat Stevens,
yeah,
kind of old, real traditional Beatles kind of songwriter person. So you really approached it from the classic way of writing. And while I was doing that, I had a pal of mine who was a film extra, and he was one of those special extras. Mm-hmm. He often got little bits and things like that in movies. And we were going up to Hollywood for some event, and he had a pass for the event, but then there was a VIP room
right
with all the stars.
Oh, my Lord.
And he blagged our way in. Mitch Markowitz. I have no idea where he is or what he's doing. But
thanks, Mitch.
Thanks, Mitch. So we went into this, swear to God, we went into this party. And it was, you know, Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and, you know, I mean, it was Warren Beatty. It was like everybody was at this thing. And I was 20. It wasn't even legal to drink or anything. Yeah. This was a big party, and I was in school. It was a school term, university. Mm. But I remember just watching all the celebrities and sitting there, and Mitch went off and was schmoozing and stuff. Mm. And I was just kind of observing it all, and I find myself sitting next to this really fit black woman. Mm. And I mean fit, like, she was poured in this red leather pantsuit.
Right.
And it was a beautiful, like, this cherry, vibrant red zipper jacket, just fit and this amazing, posture and the hair that was just completely, permed and done back and very, gorgeous, like, 80s thing, and fingernails and playing with this kind of earlier of the car phones with the big batteries that all the rich people had.
Yeah.
And we started talking about this phone and we were laughing about it. And now we're walking around with you.
Yeah, exactly.
And we just started talking, and I was telling her I was a student, but I was doing the songwriting course and I really loved writing. Mm-hmm. And we kind of walked around and we met, I have to think now because I really haven't thought so specifically, but we were just kind of going from little group to group, and she'd just take me around and she goes, this is Janet, she's a writer. And then we'd just listen and go, there were a lot of executives there, a lot of producers, and I was just kind of awash. It was just almost too much to take in. But at the end of the night, she gave me her card, and she was an A&R woman at Motown.
All right, okay.
And her name was Simone Sheffield. So I called her up. And a couple weeks later, I drove up to meet with her at their offices at Sunset and Vine in that big high rise. Yeah. And it's still there.
It's still there, yeah.
It's no longer just Motown. But this was still in the Barry Gordy Suzanne DePass.
Yeah.
Right before I think he sold it probably mid-80s or something. And so I started going up every couple. She hired me. She said, "Well, why don't you just kind of write some stuff for me, and I'll just feed it to the real songwriters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just come and hang out." And so all my pals at university, which I didn't think anything of it. It's just, this is just what I'm doing. And I would find out many, many years later that all of the guys and particularly the guys that I hung out with at the fraternity, the Kappa Sigs, and I was a Delta Gamma. And, but they all said to me about a decade ago, we had an event, and they're like, JJ, what's they call me? JJ, we just all knew you were going to do something different because you were going up to Motown, and what the heck was that about? Like, I know, but I didn't even think of it. It didn't even dawn on me that you just didn't do this.
But isn't that like the path of a creative person where they like there's an opportunity that goes in front of them, it's like not like that looks interesting, that's why not.
So no, that's how I started really seriously approaching writing. And I wrote quite a bit. I did it for a year and a half to 2 years, and I think it might have been around the time it was selling. Of the artists, I only met two artists when I was there, but one was Rick James, which was ridiculous. And he happened to be in a good mood that day.
Okay.
So that was good. And he was very nice to me. And Tina Marie, who is really cool.
Right.
And other writers and people like that. But some of the producers. Mm. But it was kind of got me started. But then I knew I really wanted to write screenplays.
Yeah. And I mean that. Yeah. But that was kind of your
introduction.
That was your kind of introduction, but knowing that, okay, I don't want to go there, because I always say it's just as important to know what you don't want to do than it is what you want to do.
Well, what I was also seeing in the music business, and I was also singing, I was doing background vocals.
Yeah, okay.
And so I would go in and record, the doo-wops and la-da-da-da-da's and all the harmonies and stuff, background stuff. And I just thought, I just didn't like I didn't like how women were treated.
Yeah.
And I just felt like the sleaze factor was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Not like it isn't in some places, but it was
Was it sleazy back then? It's not sleazy today.
Yeah. But there was a sleaze factor. Yeah. And I was okay. And I thought, I love movies.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah.
Well, that's great. And so when, I mean, how does one make that jump? Because, you know, it's, is it just like, okay, I'm going to write screenplays? Or do you just kind of go, I'm going to start writing and then I'll go to LA? Because you've lived in LA.
I lived in LA, so I was already there.
That's right. Okay, so you were already there.
Yeah.
You just started going for it. Is that it?
Yeah, my senior year of university, I wrote a short film for friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so intimidated by everything. I didn't go to film school. That wasn't my major.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I wasn't smart enough to be an English major. So, I know, it's probably due to ourselves, the stories we tell. So, I majored in marketing and journalism, and then I did a minor in American history of the Industrial Revolution. As you do.
Yeah.
So, which is now serving me well because of what I'm writing, right?
I know.
It's just so weird. And so I wrote a short film. I'm sure it was dreadful, and we were shooting it. And I thought, I really like this.
Yeah.
So I didn't really approach screenwriting until I was out of university and I started taking classes in Hollywood. And my first job was in the mailroom at Warner Brothers. And I got that through, I guess I must have been a plucky kid, young person, because that job I got because I wanted to do a paper on film publicity for my journalism class.
Mm-hmm.
So I called Warner Brothers. I don't think you can do this anymore.
Yeah.
I called Warner Brothers, talked to the switchboard, asked for someone in publicity, what I was doing, and the one patched me through to a guy who was like one of the last of the old golden era publicists.
Right.
From the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And his name was Marty Weiser.
Mm.
And I got on the phone with him. I told him what I was doing. He goes, yeah, okay, like, come on down here. I'll come on this day. I'll have a pass for you at the lot. And I'm like, woohoo! So I drove on the lot. And I go meet Marty Weiser, who was so nice. We became friends for life.
Amazing.
I wrote my paper. And then every time there was a screening at Warner Brothers, they mainly did it in Westwood,
mm-hmm.
in the Village, at one of the big things. I'd get to go to, like, the other press screenings or the other screenings. I saw everything. He said, oh, yeah, I got you on the pass, kid. And I'm like, all right, great. And so when I needed a job, I was about 5 weeks from graduation, and I called him, and I said, hey, Mr. Weiser, it's Janet Jones.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I'm going to be looking for a job. I need a job. And he said, well, call Helen in personnel in 10 minutes, and she'll be waiting for you. Okay. So 10 minutes later, I call Helen in personnel. She says, in these days, you could go meet people, which is great. She says, come in and see me. So I drive back out to Warner Brothers and meet with Helen, and I got hired for the mailroom.
So that's just to go get her attitude.
I think that still exists
today.
Yeah.
You know, you don't ask, you don't get, you know.
Well, I didn't know anyone, so I just was desperate.
Yeah. Desperation's great. Can be. Yes. Desperation can be great. it's not good to show it, but it's good to act on it. I think you spent the next how many
years at the lot, I was at the lot for about a year, and I graduated from the mailroom. I was the only female in the mailroom.
Really?
I might have been the first female hire. I know. It was all boys, and they were all cinema geeks, and so was I, so I fit right in. It was easy. And then I did their private tours. Warner Brothers is the only lot that has real proper private tours, and you take about 5 people around, and so you had access to everything.
Yeah.
You could go sit down on ADR, on
editing,
and because the guys would get to know you, and you know, I've watched everyone from Robert Redford and Clint Eastwood and a bunch of people, Marvin Hamlisch scoring. I mean, it just crazy, and you don't even think about it because you're like, oh, well, this is just what everyone's doing, It didn't really, you know, at the moment, you're just doing it. And it's like, oh, it's cool. And then I did a writing class with Neil Simon's brother, Danny.
Right.
And did I ever tell you about Danny?
No.
Oh, well, Danny. Danny was the older brother.
Right.
He was the star of the family. He was the one on working with Sid Caesar on Your Show of Shows. He was a big comedy writer with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and the young Woody Allen and all those guys. And he took his kid brother, Neil, into the fold.
Yeah.
So he could have a job. And they were doing comedy writing together. They were writing commercials together. And Neil got in on the show and started writing his first play, which was Come Blow Your Horn, which was about living with his older brother, Danny.
Yeah.
So suddenly he was using his brother as his subject.
Yeah.
And it would create this growing rift.
Yeah.
So that was a hit. He left a show of shows. Danny stayed as a comedy TV writer. Eventually ended out in L.A. You know, I think two or three times divorced. He was Oscar Madison. So Oscar was Danny.
Right.
And Gingerbread Lady was Danny's ex-wife and daughter. And Laughter on the 42nd Floor was him and Danny.
Right.
And, you know, Brighton Beach Memoirs was their fan. So Danny's life was taken over by his younger brother.
I think he missed a trick. Danny could have written the other side of the story.
Well, I don't think he just had it in him.
Yeah.
But he was not, he was a older, bitter man.
Yeah.
But he was a very good comedy teacher. And it was like a 6-week summer course. He went one night a week.
Yeah.
And every week he brought in writers and writer producers that he'd worked with.
Yeah.
And so we had amazing people come in and talk to us. And one of the people was at Norman Lear's company. And he was doing a show called Facts of Life. Jerry.
I remember
Facts of Life. I think it was Jerry Myers. So, and I went and talked to him afterwards and said, hey, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I want to write and da, da, da. And he said, well, come and see me. Again, come and
come
see me.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got his card. I called him. I went to see him. And he said, well, while you're here, let's take you by H&R. Because this was Brooke Berman.
Yeah.
The one. she was interesting. So Brooke hired me.
Amazing.
I got a new job as a driver.
Okay.
And I was waiting for an assistant job.
That's incredible. It was like, just, that's incredible.
Yeah. And so then I finally got a writer's assistant job.
Yeah.
And then I met this really great guy, Mark Hirschfeld. And we decided to start writing together. And he was a casting assistant.
Right.
And I was a writer's assistant. And now we cut to 2019.
Yeah.
And he is the casting director of the TV series we're working to
see. Yeah.
Isn't that...
Oh, my Lord.
Isn't that something?
I know. Okay, so we...
Yeah. So now I'm writing.
So now you're writing. And so you spent... And listen, you've been writing, you know, and that's... You've made a career out of writing, which is fantastic. And it's not just film, and I know you just talked about a series, but I met you, you know, at the theater.
Yes.
Well, I met you... Okay, no, I met you doing a... You know, doing we were at the old Vic, at the theater. You know, we were doing a thing at the time when I was producing with Poisson Rouge. We did a series for young writers to come and talk to writers about their craft or whatever, or developing character or whatever.
Right.
You know, but then, you know, you were doing a reading of a script about Elizabeth Barrett.
That's right.
And you know, I wanted to help you. We were interested in it as a company, you know, at that point. And, you know, we helped you put a reading.
Yeah.
That had this little unknown girl in it.
Yes.
Who couldn't, you know,
yes.
we could not raise, you know, at the time. Little girl called Ruth Wilson,
I know.
You know. And now,
We were so right.
You know, and that's kind of the beginning of our relationship. But I've seen you then go, you know, I guess my question is, you know, what made you come to London? Because I know you doing theater as well, and your plays. You know, because I'm just a theater person, a theater geek.
Right.
You know, I've seen your new playwritings and stuff like that just really flourishing. Is that something that you came to London to, I don't know, explore or develop? Or has it always been something in you that you wanted to get more stage work on?
Yeah, you know, I came with a film project, and I had... the Barrett script, and I had this Henry James thing that I was working on, and then which was European, and I had the Dickens piece, which I is sitting there waiting because it's such an epic. It is an epic piece of whether it's for TV or theater. It's not a couple hours, you know.
Yeah.
And so I had that. That was the only piece of theater I'd written, and I workshopped it in LA for about 2.5 years with Antius Theater Company. It was a real labor of love. We had 21 actors. It's one thing. It's a big cast. You take 21 actors playing 68 roles.
Wow.
And I wrote it over that 2.5 year period with the dramaturg, Paul Lazarus. And it was based on a screenplay I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So it was had underlying material, which I'd really worked out. So I didn't have to go do research because I'd spent 3 years researching the movie and had written that. But people kept saying, oh, it's so cool. Let's try it on stage. And it really worked. And I never thought I would write a play because I didn't think I was worthy. You know, I was like, oh, no, the playwrights are like they're the lucky ones.
Yeah.
So,
funny.
And I'd written a lot of screenplays. And by this point, I, you know, worked for everybody, you know, Sony and Fox and Paramount. And, you know, I'd just written a lot of movies and worked with a lot of people, developed a lot of things that never got made.
Yeah.
Which is,
but that's part of the course. That's a writer's. I mean, everyone thinks writers get their things made. Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Writers write. You know, producers make. So there are lots of things that get developed, and you never.
Right.
Those are the times. You know, you don't see everybody's name on a title role that has worked on a script.
No, and they really should have their names.
Yeah.
I feel that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the way it stands is like you can work on 10 scripts that get made and not have your name anywhere.
Right. Oh, right. No, I've had that happen. You know. Yeah, I've had the draft that sold the movie that got the cast.
Yeah.
And then somebody's friend comes in.
And
suddenly. I don't have a credit, and it's my script on the screen, and you're like, what the?
Yeah.
So you're like, whoa, that was really shitty.
Yeah.
But, hey, what can you do?
Yeah.
That's life. And you either are in it or you're not.
Yeah.
So you just go on. Yeah, no. So when I came here, I had an idea that became Even.
Mm. Okay.
And it was somebody I was sitting with at dinner and was telling me a story about their personal life that I really didn't want to know, but you know, people, it was an executive and he was just drinking way too much and like, woe is me and my girlfriend and then these people, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So he told me this story and I got on the tube and literally from the time I got in the tube to at Piccadilly and or at Oxford and went up to Maida Vale, I knew it was a play.
Yeah.
I knew it was a play. Yeah. I knew the people. I started writing stuff literally on a street. I had a folded up, paper placemat. I've written on a lot of placemats. I've written on a lot of things. And I just kind of charted out this story and it became Even.
Right.
And
Even Even was put on, it's been workshopped at the Park Theater.
That's right.
And that's right. I mean, still has a life. We were chatting about it today. You know, it's a great play.
Well, it's nice. It's a little timeless because there's nothing outside of their experience of these characters.
Mm.
So you can...
Yeah.
You know, it's not locked in by, you know, a war or this or that. It's it's really about how people misbehave.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That seems to be a theme
these days. Yes, I know. Otherwise they really don't.
Yeah, exactly. I guess what I'm trying to do is get this full sense of, you know, it's great, Jen, just to sit down and talk and go, God, you have done so much. And and still creating and still writing. And I know there are things on the horizon. Even will happen. I know that play will go on.
Yeah.
You know, we're reading another play of yours,
a new play
of yours next week, which is great. Yeah. That's going to sound good to, you know, is hearing it come off the page.
Yeah. And it's the first American play.
I know. Well, yes.
Is that weird?
American
first
play.
American
because
play.
You write a lot of British British subjects.
Yes.
You know, whether it be literary or historical figures or, you know,
or people, it's a weird thing. Yeah,
They come. Yeah, they come easily to you and you write really well, period. You know, as actors, we get a lot of period, we read a lot of period scripts, but you write really well for period drama or whatever you want to call it, period pieces.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your new play.
A new play.
And why American after so long?
Well, they just came that way. Okay. I've been thinking about wanting to write about a person who may or may not be beyond redemption.
Right.
Of just, and not in a, you know, they're not a malevolent, horrible person, but they're just, they've missed a lot of things in their life and they're missing their, they're missing all the cues. They're missing all the important things. And that was what I'd always wanted to write about. And I wanted to write, could somebody who'd not been very kind to people at times, have a real awakening about it,
yeah,
and own it.
Yeah.
And but genuinely own it.
Yeah.
And expand their ability to look outside themselves. So that was the character, and I had been thinking about it and thinking about it, and I was interested in old hurts. Mm-hmm. And if you had an old hurt from someone, could you run into them, and would that really go away? Could you the other person be really in forgiveness? Could the other person be in a place of asking for not even your forgiveness, but just to deeply and genuinely apologize and own their behavior? So that was the real gist of it. And or do you just die and go to hell? Those thoughts. So it's like
that's the 2 minute play.
So let's see what happens. And one day, I really truly, I got up and I don't know what I was thinking about. I sat down at the computer and I suddenly saw all the characters. Mm. All the characters just kind of were there, like here in the ether. And I went, oh, geez, this is for that play.
Yeah.
And I knew a lot about them.
Mm.
So I was literally sitting there with a yellow pen.
Writing
about kind of who they basically were.
Yeah, yeah.
And I grab a big sheet of construction paper so I can really see them all on page. And I was like, oh, okay, I guess I'm going to write this.
Yeah.
And I have to look back in my papers, but I must have, because I always do this, kind of sit down and I'll kind of chart out what happens. But it kind of knew what it was going to be. So I didn't have to do much. And I sat down and just started writing this play.
Yeah.
And I thought, I wrote it in like 5 days.
Yeah.
I mean, it just came. Not everything comes like
that.
Yeah,
you know? Of course.
Even came very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, the Elizabeths, once I did all the research, came, but I had to stop and research, recheck things, so it was all factual.
Yeah.
But this thing, I started, and like the sun showed up, and I knew who they were. And it's like, I'm just going to keep going with this.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when the person from the past shows up, it was just really interesting, and it kind of knew its rhythm. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it, because it doesn't always happen that way. In screenplays, it never happens, because it's a completely different,
it's a different beast.
Discipline.
Yeah.
You have to scene out everything.
Yeah.
Whereas in the play, I think that's why they write faster. They come and it's like a whoosh.
Well, it's like songs. Yeah. People say, I sat down and wrote a song in 2 minutes.
Most of my songs are 2 to 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's done.
Just do it. Yeah.
And because if you don't, it is gone.
Yeah.
It's like a freight train.
Yeah.
And plays are like a moving train.
Yeah.
And films are like a walk. And you have to stop in the woods and sit there.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of. So they're very different
beasts.
But I also think because a play is going to be done in the time.
Yeah.
So you're also in the time. Whereas a film, it could be this is 6 months later and then we're here. And what is the camera picking up? So you've got to think, of yourself as the camera.
Yeah.
And the actor, and what's the information, and all that stuff. Where in a play, you're just worried about what's happening between all the people.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoosh. It's a whoosh.
Yeah.
And even those freaking monologues.
Yeah.
I don't know where that came, but I I knew about him, so I was reading. I sat down, I read things I thought his son was interested in. Well, I knew he was interested in.
Yeah.
This was his stuff. So I was reading these different articles in the New York Times and stuff, old articles. I was going through archives on like physics and time and matter and invention. And, but then I just sat down. So when I got to him, all these things just came out.
Yeah.
So I feel like the characters tell you where to go and what to look for. And
I think it's a smart play. There is no, you don't lower the bar. You don't, there's no lower common denominators. You like, these guys are academics. They're, you know, they're smart people, but they're also artistic people. You know, they're okay, I've got my degree, but I want to be a tattoo artist. You know,
which is that kind of funny.
Which is real, you know, which is real.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I have friends who's, you know, I have these kids who are geniuses, and they're off on farms trying to figure out how to like invent sound wave therapy.
Yeah.
And I went, what? Or the best tattoo artist in Manhattan Beach or whatever.
You know? Manhattan Beach, love Manhattan Beach. okay, Janet, let's think about what. Okay, so these are things that you've got bubbling. Now there are things that are happening. You know that you just mentioned the Elizabeths. So you've written a play about the Elizabeths,
right?
About the queens.
Use your imagination.
Yes, like, about the queens of England.
Yes,
and the Elizabeths having a chit chat, you know, coexisting.
Yes. Yes.
And that's kind of...
They have their Rod Serling moment.
Yes, exactly.
You know who that is. Yeah. You're good.
You've got that kind of... That's developing, and it's kind of looks like it's going to happen next year.
Next year.
Actually, at the Tower.
For a couple or three performances, depending how we set up the production, because we don't know what they're open. I mean, they've said if you want to do two or three nights.
Yeah. Well, listen, fingers crossed. Something's happening. That workshop's
happening,
which is great.
Because the chapel's small, and they want to raise a lot of money. Yeah. It's a cool space. Have you been in it?
No.
No?
Nope.
Okay, well,
I
got it.
I have to go.
When we go, I'll just take you to come with us.
And then you've got a series that...
Yes.
I mean, I don't like to... Listen, you've got a series that could be massive, could be huge, could be, you know, it's...
We have to cast.
Yeah,
and we
have to cast.
It's cast contingent.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
But everything else is in play. Everything. Which is really nice. I mean, everything.
Yeah.
All the people we need, the team. But the team's been in place... everybody has been in place. Scott Winant and I for 11 years, and Mike and Brenda for 10 years.
Yeah, so that you know, I've known you for almost that long. Longer. And I think that, you know, seeing knowing about the project from its early days, but seeing it so you've not stopped. You know, that's like for writers especially, you guys are creating.
Right.
You know, actors get the thing at the last minute.
You get it at the last minute.
You know, the last minute before writers.
That's really
true. You're constantly working on your thing, constantly building your repertoire. Your stable is huge. You've got things that you go and visit. Yes.
I have a trunk.
Yeah.
I have a trunk.
It's no longer a box.
I have a big ass trunk.
Big ass trunk. That's a great name for a jazz band, isn't it?
Big ass trunks. Yeah. Pendleton, you want to front that?
So, can you? Are you on socials, Janet? Do you do socials?
I have Instagram for the dog.
Well,
yes, the dog.
There's been a dog sitting on your lap. You haven't heard about it.
No,
but where can you find Pen the dog?
Pendleton is Pendleton's mom. All one word. The American spelling. M-M.
Right. Okay.
And so he's there. You know, I have. I have a writing website page. I have Twitter, you know, and a Facebook page for for the writing as and for the podcast. I've set them up. But I don't do it unless I have something to really say about it. You know, I don't do politics and stuff like that because everybody else is doing that.
And last thing, quickly, because you talked about the podcast. You have a film.
New film podcast
podcast that you're about to do, which is going to be taking you through trivia and music of the films and all of your favorite.
Right, 117 years of cinema.
Oh
I say it's 117 years of a lot of great movies that most people probably haven't seen, but would love.
Yeah,
and I don't start with the, you know, usual 10. I really just picked movies I love and get going.
Yeah.
And you know, like, I haven't even gotten to Citizen Kane yet because, you know, everybody, you know what I'm saying? I'll get there.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I feel like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've done it on the radio, kind of.
Yes.
The seed has been on the radio, so now you're kind of moving it across.
Right, because on the radio, like I was saying to you, it moves very quickly. I can't go into all the detail. I can't play as much of music clips or even scene clips. And I'll tell you what's really interesting when I've been putting this together. Pulling from comedies a scene, especially the newer ones, that really works is very hard because some of the writing isn't that great, even if it's funny.
Yeah.
But if you go back, probably into the 90s and back, you can find scenes where the dialogue, you know, in a Harry Met Sally or a Woody Allen. And, you know, all these...
Yeah.
There are scenes, like you can pull a minute or two.
Yeah.
And just listening to the conversation, you're laughing.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of the newer stuff, it's not, there's a sometimes, but not, like there was. So that's interesting to pull from comedy. Drama, yeah. It's much easier.
Yeah.
Or and then I also do quotes. Sometimes I'll just literally pull a 10-second quote, an 8-second quote.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, go ahead, make my day. That's like 5 seconds, yeah. Right? That's all. And so then people can like guess and they can send in to the website, you know, their...
I think it's just such a great idea. I think it sounds really... I can't wait to hear that. Well, we'll put show notes, like where you can find all your stuff.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you.
And we will, of course, keep everyone...
And Pendleton. Finding Pendleton.
Finding Pendleton.
Hello.
Anyway, Janet Jones, thank you very much for sitting and having a great
really
chat.
Fun. Yeah.
Playwright, screenwriter, author, poet, lyricist, just to name a few things, Janet Doolin Jones. Now, before I go, just a few housekeeping notes. If you're a theater professional, head on over to curtaincallonline.com and sign up for a free profile page. All you have to do is create an account with an email address, make up a cool password, and away you go. You can follow us on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Curtain Call, and you can follow me at John Schwab. That is JohnSchwab, and that's on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everywhere. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions or feedback for the podcast, just get in touch with me via any of the social media platforms I just mentioned, or write to me personally at john@curtaincallonline.com. It just leaves me to say a huge thank you to my wonderful friend, Janet Jones. I will put some social links in the show notes for you. No doubt you'll be hearing much more from Janet's work in the coming months and years, including plays The Elizabeths and Even, and A Short Tale About Heartache, which is what we were talking about workshopping this week, as well as her TV series, Gramercy Park. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, and I will catch you all next week. Bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.